Is there any way out of Venezuela's electoral fraud nightmare? Can Miami-Dade's guardianship program clean up its act? And can Florida lure back Hollywood? Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll assess what, if anything, the U.S., the international community, and the diaspora here can do to dislodge Venezuelan dictator Nicolas Maduro from power after his massive vote fraud. We'll also examine a Miami-Dade County Inspector General report that bears out WLRN's probe of the guardianship program for the vulnerable and elderly. And we'll look at a push in places like Palm Beach County to bring movie making back to the Sunshine State. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Well, we all braced for it. Before last Sunday's presidential election in Venezuela, we all knew the question wasn't whether dictatorial President Nicolas Maduro would try to commit voter fraud, but how. And Sunday night, we found out. Even though credible exit polls showed the intensely unpopular Maduro losing to opposition challenger Edmundo González by a landslide, Venezuela's authoritarian socialist regime, astonishingly, declared Maduro the winner by a 51% to 44% margin, arbitrarily. Condemnation inside and outside Venezuela was loud and swift, especially since Maduro refuses to hand over the official vote tally sheets. But it may not matter. Maduro has his loyal and brutal military backing him up, and as other dictatorships in Latin America, like Cuba's and Nicaragua's, show us, that trumps any pressure the U.S. and the international community bring to bear. Meanwhile, millions more Venezuelans now look set to flee their country and head for the overwhelmed U.S. southern border. So what, if anything, can be done to dislodge Maduro and reverse Venezuela's severe humanitarian crisis, the worst in modern South American history? Joining me now in the studio to tackle this tragedy is Eduardo Gamarra, a political science professor and Latin American politics expert at Florida International University. Also with us is Maria Alejandra Marquez. She heads the Venezuelan expat activist nonprofit Venezuelan Asset Recovery Initiative, or INRAV. Welcome to you both.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thank you, team.
No, thank you. But Maria Alejandra, I want to start with you as a leader of the Venezuelan community here. Last night, the Biden administration announced that it has concluded there is, quote, overwhelming evidence that opposition candidate Edmundo González did indeed win Sunday's presidential election by millions of votes. And Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on President Maduro to start working out a transition of power. Do you and other Venezuelans here think there's any realistic possibility of that happening?
Well, more than realistic possibility, team, I think what we have learned through this process and this last year is that there is no effort that is not worth pursuing when you are facing such a cruel dictatorship. A lot of people would say that Venezuelans are innocent in having pursued this election, knowing that Maduro was going to commit fraud. But I think against tyranny, you have to keep trying. Having the backing of the international community is certainly an incentive for Venezuelans to keep fighting.
Right. I remember you and I speaking last Sunday during the election, and you made that point that a lot of people might think Venezuelans were being naive, as you put it, to pursue an election when they knew Maduro was going to try to commit a voter fraud. But the diaspora here and Venezuelans inside the country had taken a lot of extraordinary measures, like creating these comanditos, these little voter activism cells that were going to be much more vigilant. Do you think those efforts sort of helped bring a lot more international pressure on Maduro that he's feeling now that he otherwise wouldn't be feeling?
Oh, of course, by any means. The fact that we have the information on the voting public to be seen is because of the incredible and brave work of Venezuelans who risked their lives to have the register of the voting in every polling site. And this comes with organization, this comes with participation, this comes with a lot of motivation from within Venezuela. And I would like to convey to your listeners the huge risk these people were facing just by doing that. Right. And as we speak, they are being sought off by security forces on their houses to being taken in detention just by exercising a right that is included in the Venezuelan electoral law.
No, I even got a text this morning from a friend in Venezuela saying that there are roadblocks now in her state because police are checking your cell phones to see if you've got any messages from opposition leaders, that kind of thing. It's getting nuts. Eduardo Gamarra, I think we need to establish something at the outset here. You and I have been watching Latin American politics for decades, but this, to me, is the most brazen, shocking incidence of electoral fraud I've ever witnessed in the region. And I say that remembering full well how bad the fraud was in Mexico in 1988, for example, or Panama in 1989. Where would you rate Maduro's election theft in Venezuela this week?
No, by far, Tim, it is probably the most egregious case in at least in the last 60 years, and, you know, because there's not even any embarrassment behind it. It is just so brazen. They essentially have pulled off something which they were able to pull off before in large measure because the results were much closer.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no question that, you know, this isn't the first time they've conducted fraud.
Right.
But in past elections, the results were much closer, and therefore they were able to kind of hide their fraud. But this time they just simply couldn't, and that's why they have to go through extreme lengths now, probably to make up the results.
Right.
And I think they also didn't anticipate how far technology has gone in the last few years, which in fact has enabled the opposition to demonstrate the extraordinary fraud that has been conducted.
Right, that goes back to Maria Alejandra's point earlier that the opposition seemed a lot more prepared. They knew the fraud was coming, but they were much more prepared this time to expose it. Is that a fair assessment?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think the opposition became prepared, largely learned from previous mistakes, because look, there was fraud in 2013, there was fraud in 2017,
and 2018, and they
also had something else in mind, which is really an important dimension of this. Fraud is possible for Venezuela largely because there was an international community that was willing to go along with them.
Right.
And so they had always, you know, prepared even before the results were ready. They already had, you know, Cristina Fernandez saying congratulations and so on, and Cuba, and everything else. And I
want to get to that. But Eduardo, the question now is, what can the U.S. and the international community realistically do to get Maduro and his criminal regime, especially his criminal military, to first cough up the legitimate voter precinct tally sheets that show he lost, and second, concede that loss? Is there anything that could be done at this point?
I think the international community is doing what it can. There are now, I think, the correct step is being taken, which is to recognize Edmundo González as the person who won the election legitimately. And at least to my count now, at least the U.S., Argentina, and Uruguay have done so. I think if we can get other countries to do so, that will work.
Well, those other countries is the sticking point. Things didn't look promising this week when three of Latin America's largest countries, Brazil, Mexico, and Colombia, all ruled by leftists like Maduro, abstained from a vote at the Organization of American States, or OAS, to demand Maduro hand over the vote tally sheets. We're hearing from those three countries that they're working to get Maduro to cooperate. U.S. sources, however, tell us they're not really pushing him that hard, meaning those three countries. I want to ask both of you, what do you think is going on behind the diplomatic scenes, Eduardo?
Well, I think, you know, I can't say for Mexico, but certainly Brazil. Remember that Celso Amorim, one of the most distinguished former foreign minister, has been in the thick of things. And I think Brazil and Colombia have some other motives to be to want to be mediators in this. Remember that if there is, and there will most likely be a new migration wave,
yeah,
they're going to feel it first.
No, exactly.
So they want to mm-hmm. feel that they are mediators in this, and that's, I think, the main reason why they didn't vote with the majority at the OAS. But again, you know, they are, at least in Petro's case, you know, Petro usually talks out of both sides. And
Petro being the president, Gustavo Petro being the president of Colombia, a leftist.
Colombia,
yeah,
exactly.
Right.
Right.
Maria Alejandra, Venezuela's very popular opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, who, as we know, would have been the candidate challenging Maduro mm-hmm. last Sunday, but he had barred her from running, says she is now in hiding in Venezuela and is afraid for her life. But she released a video last night calling on Venezuelans inside and outside the country to stage mass demonstrations tomorrow. Is there any real possibility of a mass civilian uprising in Venezuela that could force Maduro to give up power?
Well, I don't know if it's a real possibility. What I can tell you is the Venezuelans are willing to try. They are hearing this call from Maria Corina Machado, not only in Venezuela, but abroad. Here in Miami, there will be an event on Saturday at 10 a.m. as well. But it is unclear what's going to happen because the repression is being so hard on people that, of course, there is a lot of fear. There are direct threats against journalists, direct threats against citizens had participated in the voting polls, so that there is a huge amount of fear. We're going to see if Saturday, definitely, if the campaign, if the violent campaign of the government had results that allow them to control the situation, or if the people are willing still to go out and keep fighting. What I would say is what I'm hearing is there is a lot of will to keep fighting, but I don't want to presume that I know because I'm not in the ground feeling that pressure.
But yesterday Maduro even started talking about putting protesters in concentration camps.
Yes.
Eduardo, far from accepting his defeat, is this the moment Maduro and the Chavistas, as his regime is known, named for the Venezuelan Socialist Revolution's late founder, Hugo Chavez, is this the moment they seem to be morphing into Stalin?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, Tim, I know that maybe later you want to bring in external actors, but I think there's a critical difference here. You know, the fact that the fraud scheme did not work now requires them to find other justifications, and the main justification is to blame everybody from Elon Musk to obviously the opposition. And, but they're cracking down, and they're following a model that, you know, which is to round up a lot of people, jail them, put them in camps, put them in the worst prison camps in Venezuela. Mm. And they're doing so now, and we now have significant evidence that there are, you know, there's a group of Cubans that have arrived. There's even rumors of a Bolivian police contingent, which just arrived yesterday or the day before.
Yeah.
There's also very strong rumors that there are Belarusians and members of the Wagner group, you know, again, all unconfirmed.
Yeah.
But the reality is that this is no longer just a Venezuelan issue, right? There's a geopolitical reality involved here as well. And my sense is because the Russians are there, it's a much more serious issue. And the Russians are unwilling, right, to see Maduro fail.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with FIU's Eduardo Gamarra and Venezuelan expat leader Maria Alejandra Marquez about what can be done to stop what looks like epic voter fraud in last Sunday's Venezuelan presidential election. Maria Alejandra, let's step back for a second and remind people why, according to the exit polls and what we know about the legitimate vote count, why Maduro lost Sunday's election so badly. On the one hand, Venezuelans are tired of his dictatorial rule, but as I mentioned earlier, he's also responsible for the economic implosion of what was once one of the world's most oil-rich countries and the worst humanitarian crisis in modern South American history. How bad is day-to-day life in Venezuela?
Well, you have to imagine trying to live with a basic income of, I don't know, $4 a day in a country that, after the scarcity of goods, opened up to uncontrolled imports, and everything is dollar priced. And in Venezuela, there is even inflation in dollars, which was something that was never seen in the past. So it's a really hard life unless you're definitely connected with some sort of business related to government.
Right.
And that makes a population particularly vulnerable to political pressures, because then the government
right.
steps in and starts handing out food or helps.
And as your organization, INROV, has monitored for years now, that humanitarian crisis has been worsened by the surreal level of corruption, the billions and billions of dollars Maduro and his regime have allegedly stolen from Venezuela's coffers. Was that also a big reason Venezuelans voted to get rid of Maduro on Sunday?
Well, I think definitely it's a cause. We need to remember that just conservatively, between $300 to $500 billion dollars have been stolen by the Chavez and Maduro regime in the last 25 years. And this is very conservatively.
Right. So, and we should remind people that's another big reason Maduro and his regime don't want to give up power, because they're staring at jail, perhaps, if they lose.
Of course. And not only this situation, and going to your question, has created a humanitarian crisis, because all the money that should have gone to public services, to hospitals, to electricity, everything was stolen. So all the infrastructure of the country is crumbling, and it's affecting the day-to-day lives of people. Businesses have closed, so people have had to fled.
Right.
And this immigration has created the main motivation of people to vote, which is to
right.
reunite families.
And Edward... I'm sorry. I just wanted to get Eduardo. That brings us back to the diplomatic effort that you referred to a little earlier to get Maduro to step down, because polls show millions of Venezuelans intend to leave the country if Maduro remains in power. That would add to the almost 8 million Venezuelans who've already fled in the past decade, about a quarter of the population, meaning it would add to the heavy Venezuelan migrant burden neighboring countries, as well as the U.S., have already taken on in recent years, as you mentioned. Is that making it then more urgent for them to pressure Maduro right now?
I think so. And, you know, if you were able to listen to the foreign ministers and the ambassadors at the OAS in particular, the really fascinating performance by the foreign minister of Peru, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peru has received over a million Venezuelans, and now there's no embassy. So Venezuelans who you know, who need basic services, basic consular services,
mm-hmm.
have nowhere to go. And the same thing is being repeated in Chile. It's being repeated in every country that where, you know, remember that Maduro has essentially expelled anybody
right.
who has complained about the results. So I think that, you know, the diplomatic pressure is going to continue,
right.
and it should continue. But I think as Maria Alejandra was mentioning a moment ago, I think that, you know, unfortunately, the situation in Venezuela is going to get much, much worse before it gets any
right.
better.
So as a result, Maria Alejandra, as a Venezuelan expat leader, I'm curious to know what you would tell President Biden right now if you had the chance to advise him on how to pressure Maduro. As we mentioned earlier, Maduro and his regime are wanted in the U.S. and around the world for crimes like drug trafficking and money laundering. Should the U.S., for example, be working harder to make a deal with Maduro and his regime that keeps him and his top lieutenants out of jail if they do give up power? What would you advise President Biden if you could sit down with him?
Well, I know for Venezuelans, it's been a hard pill to swallow, the idea that Maduro could get freed if he negotiates. But I would say, and I don't mean now to represent the whole Venezuelan diaspora, but if that would guarantee him leaving the country and allow Venezuelans to start working towards a future of progress and creation, a strengthening of democratic institutions and a better economy, and bringing all the Venezuelans that are out back, I think that's a trade I'm willing to support.
Okay.
The thing is Maduro willing to negotiate? What they had poor
yeah.
negotiations last year, thanks to the sanctions,
mm-hmm.
and that's a very controversial issue, just to say the least.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. We'll have to see. Eduardo Gamarra is a Latin American politics expert at Florida International University. Maria Alejandra Marquez heads the Venezuelan expat activist nonprofit, Venezuelan Assets Recovery Initiative, or INRAV. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Last year, a WLRN investigation exposed the questionable practices of a private Miami-Dade nonprofit agency, the Guardianship Program. Its role is to assume care of people deemed incapacitated, including by taking control of their homes that they may need to sell. But WLRN found that the Guardianship Program often sold the homes at lowball prices, while the firm it sold them to resold them for big profits. What's more, WLRN's probe discovered that the firm's owner was the husband of then-Miami City Attorney Victoria Mendez. The WLRN investigation, titled Unguarded, has since won several awards, but this week it also won some official vindication. A Miami-Dade County Inspector General report has determined that the Guardianship Program's staff's home sales practices violated Florida state law, as well as the nonprofit agency's own policies. The 137-page audit also found a gross lack of oversight and cited multiple conflicts of interest. Guardianship program directors are challenging those inspector general findings. What's your response to this latest and very critical spotlight on the Guardianship Program? Have you had any encounter with the agency? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio are the two journalists who produced WLRN's Unguarded investigation, investigative reporter Danny Rivero and government accountability reporter Joshua Ceballos. Gentlemen, always great to have you on.
Great to be here.
Great to be here, Tim.
Danny, first recap for our listeners what the Guardianship Program is and what it was exactly that you and Josh uncovered last year in the Unguarded investigation about its home sale practices that was so troubling.
So in short, what we found was, you know, people go into this program, they're deemed legally incapacitated.
Right.
And the program essentially takes control of their assets. And, you know, one of the assets that many people have is real estate. And they have the legal right under the state of Florida to sell the properties that are owned by these incapacitated people.
So the incapacitated people can have the resources they need.
Yeah. Right, right. It's supposed to be in benefit of the person who's been deemed incapacitated. And what we found was often the sales were very low, to the point where people were...
The sale prices
were very low, to the point that we found several times where almost immediately the property was resold for significantly higher numbers, which brought into question, were they fulfilling their fiduciary duty to sell it at a higher price to get money for the,
right,
because you
would think that the duty would be to sell it at the highest price possible originally so that the incapacitated person that's being cared for can have the most resources in return.
Exactly. No? That was the real question that we were really highlighting.
And the folks involved included then Miami City Attorney Victoria Mendez.
Right.
Why was that also a disturbing wrinkle?
So what we found was that the guardianship, our investigation focused on how the guardianship program was repeatedly selling to this one firm, Express Homes, which was owned by Carlos Morales, who is the husband of former Miami City Attorney Victoria Mendez.
Right.
And actually, Victoria Mendez and Carlos Morales live in a home that was bought from the guardianship program. And that just raised a whole lot of questions because this is a government official who had connections with, you know, government agencies and was benefiting from a nonprofit that receives government funding.
Right. So this is where the whole conflict of interest layer came into play. Danny, what was the response last year from both the Guardianship Program and Miami-Dade County to your Unguarded investigation?
From the Guardianship Program off the bat, we were told, you know, we tried to interview them many times, and we were told, what are you guys looking into? There's nothing wrong. We're not doing anything wrong.
Right.
You know, you're digging up dirt. People accuse us of being paid by someone to do an attack. I mean, no. There was an effort to discredit it.
Mm-hmm.
But then on the county government side, there was immediately County Commissioner Eileen Higgins called on the Inspector General's office to investigate.
Right. And, and explain to us really quickly, what is that relationship between the guardianship program and Miami-Dade County government that would have led, you know, a Miami-Dade County commissioner to step in?
Right. So they receive a significant amount of funds, millions of dollars per year to run this program, because it is in the public benefit. And they also receive millions of dollars from the state government.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, so, I mean, and we should say that's because the guardianship program handles about 20% of the county's guardianship cases. So whenever there's a case in the probate court where someone needs a guardian because they are incapacitated, they're old or mentally ill or disabled, and they don't have anyone in their family to take care of them, that's when the guardianship program steps in. So they have a big duty in the
county. It's an important job.
Okay. Yeah. So then, Josh, sum up for us then what this new Miami-Dade County Inspector General report has now concluded about the guardianship program. The most obvious takeaway, of course, as I mentioned, is that it determined the program has in fact violated state law, which you and Danny did not go so far to assert in your investigation last year. So how exactly did it conclude that the program violated the law?
Right. So in our initial investigation, we were very clear to say, like, we don't know if there's any criminal activity. We're not asserting that. But now the Inspector General's office has basically said, yes, employees of the guardianship program violated state law with regards to conflict of interest.
Okay.
So basically, property coordinators for the program were themselves benefiting from their work that were supposed to take care of incapacitated individuals. So in one case that was highlighted, a property coordinator whose job is to check out the home that belongs to this incapacitated person, see what's up with it and put it up for sale. This person ended up getting it sold to his girlfriend, who he later married and moved into that house with.
Yeah.
Or another property coordinator that sold it to a close friend and business associate. And that violates the conflict of interest laws with regards to guardianship.
Yeah, not good optics. Danny, the Inspector General said the guardianship program was also really negligent when it came to its own oversight of its home sales practices and just generally about following its own policies. What did it find was particularly egregious in that respect?
Right. So some of it, so to take, for example, you know, the program does not sell homes as a matter of course. So they hire out realtors to do the job of selling the homes. And they had at the beginning a list of 10 realtors, real estate agents, I should say, who they worked with or that they were available to work with.
Yeah.
The report found that 84.5% of, sorry, I'm talking about a property appraisals in that one.
Sure.
But 84% of the property appraisals that were done were performed by just 3 property appraisers out of a list of a possible 15. And more than half of the properties were sold by just 3 real estate agents out of a possible 10. They were supposed to cycle them out.
Okay, and so appropriate oversight would have caught something.
They would have caught something. Yeah, and then further, the report analyzed the sales of these specific real estate agents and said, well, some of these agents almost never list these properties on the MLS. They never put it on Trulia. They never put it on Zillow. They didn't do these things that can alert the general public that this home is up for sale, you know, create some bidding and push the price up probably. They didn't do that in a lot of these cases.
And I think the really one of the biggest, most egregious things that I saw as well was that the real estate agents were getting commissions that were several times over what the actual incapacitated person would get. So the real estate agent was getting a commission for one sale of like $13,000, and the incapacitated person got like $2,000 for the sale of their home.
And that's a commission in some cases without putting it on any website or marketing.
Again, pretty bad optics. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Danny Rivero and Joshua Ceballos about their investigation of the Miami-Dade Guardianship Program and the Inspector General report that just corroborated their findings. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Danny, were you and Josh surprised by how strongly the Miami-Dade County Inspector General report corroborates what the two of you reported in your unguarded investigation about the guardianship program? In fact, can we say it even added findings to your investigation? Not just that the program violated the law, but in terms of other organizational failures and bad practices.
I mean, definitely. There's few times you know, in this business as a reporter,
yeah,
where you have government agencies essentially like checking your homework, grading your homework. Did you get it right? Uh-huh. And you're a little bit nervous. Like, did we get it right? Yes. Everything we reported is reflected somehow in the findings. And they went further. There was a lot of things we were not able to find. Mm-hmm. And they're laid out in black and white on the page. And to tell you the truth, was I surprised? I was reading through it and my jaw was on the floor. I was like, wow, I didn't imagine all that.
Now, one of your sources for the unguarded investigation was Emma Ladson. She'd been evicted from her mother's home after she became a ward of the state. And then the guardianship program sold the home. Here's her response this week to the Miami-Dade Inspector General's audit.
It feels like vindication. It's just been happening for so long to too many people. I'm ecstatic and really impressed with WLRN and happy that Mayor Levine Cava is taking notice and has not let this case go.
Vindication for her and, I imagine, for the two of you. But, Josh, guardianship program executives, however, are challenging the Inspector General's report. What exactly are they disputing, and do they really have any grounds for disputing it in your right. in your estimation?
So as part of the audit report, it includes a response from the guardianship program, and they don't exactly go in and refute specific line items in the audit. They just say broadly, we are not guilty of any criminal violations, just like some slight lack of oversight, to which the auditors, the inspector general, rebutted, well, actually, there is some possible criminal violations here.
That raises another question here. That I mean, the audit is saying, okay, state law was violated, so that would naturally lead then to the question, what's going to come of that? Could we see actual criminal investigation and prosecution?
So that's a good point. And we know for a fact that the Miami-Dade State Attorney's Office is in receipt of the audit report. The Inspector General's Office told us that, and the State Attorney's Office confirmed that to us. So I guess we're going to have to see if there's anything coming out of that. But I think, I mean, there's a possibility something may come down from the state, because I think, as Danny mentioned earlier, the guardianship program gets funding from the county, but they also get a lot of funding from the state. The Department of Elder Affairs. So that remains to be seen.
But Danny, what if any sort of reform, even before this audit came out this week, mm-hmm. what if any sort of reform of the guardianship program have we seen since WLRN's unguarded investigation came out last year? Anything?
Well, we weren't aware of it, actually, until this report came out. But the two property coordinators that were basically managing, you know, the sale of these properties, the ones that the report said they violated state law, both of them resigned from their positions.
Okay.
So that happened. The guardianship program, through the report, says that they have instituted some internal policies and more checklists and things like that. And, you know, but the Inspector General's office did say, okay, a policy is good, but we've not seen it in action. So mm-hmm. they've created paper trail and paperwork, mm-hmm. but the report's pretty clear that they're not sure that that's actually
okay,
going
so
on.
Your investigation did shake the tree a bit in that regard. But Josh, as I mentioned at the outset, you guys have won accolades, deservedly so, for the Unguarded Report. You're including national recognition from the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization. But Josh, why do you feel this investigation was important? And why is it so important that Miami-Dade County has followed up the way it has?
Well, I think that even in the report, it says that the Inspector General's office was already starting to do an audit of the guardianship program. But after media reports like ours led to calls from county commissioners and from the county mayor for an investigation, their audit expanded and they were able to find a lot of these mm-hmm. Potentially criminal activities and this lack of oversight. And I think that is going to lead to some, hopefully some real change in the program. And listen, incapacitated people. The incapacitated people who are wards of the program are the most vulnerable in our community.
That's what I would. That's the most important thing about your guys' work. Mm-hmm. This focuses on vulnerable people.
Vulnerable people who are elderly, who are disabled, who have mental illness, and who have no one else in their family or their friends to take care of them, and their homes are being sold. And that's why this is important.
And Danny, then finally, let me ask you the same question, particularly in the sense of how this reminds us of why local journalism is so important.
I mean, thanks for the question, but it really speaks to the core of, you know, a lot of what drives us. Like, when you become a journalist, and especially when you're doing local journalism, you want to be able to do things that actually have an impact, actually,
sure,
you know, make the world better in some kind of way and shine light into dark places. And I think, you know, I'm very proud of what we did in this project.
Absolutely.
And I think, yep, you know, the response from, you know, awards and whatnot, but also, like, after our report came out, they stopped selling homes. Mm-hmm. Because the county pressured them to. They're still not selling homes until they figure out these new processes and whatnot, so that hopefully moving forward, these issues don't happen again.
No, you definitely shone the spotlight where it needed to be shown. So thanks very much. Danny Rivero and Joshua Ceballos are WLRN investigative reporters. You can read and listen to their award-winning expose, Unguarded, at WLRN.org. Many thanks to you both, and congratulations again on the great work.
Thanks, Tim.
You'd think Florida and movie making would go together like, well, to quote one really famous movie, Forrest Gump, peas and carrots. Like California, we've got nonstop sunshine and a sexy aura that ought to make the state a film and TV production mecca. But it ain't that simple. Turns out Florida has become as expensive for filmmakers as it is for apartment hunters. And the state has let funds for financial incentives dry up. As a result, Florida productions like the Oscar-winning Moonlight from 2016 are, these days, the exception rather than the rule. But there's a movement afoot to lure back Hollywood, the movie star Hollywood, that is. In South Florida, in particular, film commissions from Palm Beach to the Keys are working to fashion new incentives, especially to capture the boom in productions for streaming services like Apple TV+, where the series Bad Monkey, shot in South Florida, premieres this month. Do you think Florida should be a prime film location again? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter, Wilkin Brutus, who's been following this trend. Wilkin, how are you?
Hey, Tim. All is well.
Great to hear it. Let's listen to the intro to your WLRN report this week, which features the trailer to that Apple TV Plus production, Bad Monkey, that I just mentioned.
I'm suspended. I'm technically not even a detective anymore. They said I was consistently reckless, inappropriate, and glib.
That's actor Vince Vaughn, starring as a disgraced Miami police detective turned restaurant inspector who falls into a world of corruption.
My gut is telling me that there's somebody who's keeping an eye on me because of what I know, but I really don't know what I know.
Beautiful coastlines, swamps, vibrant neighborhoods, and urban scenes. What's not to like about shooting films in Florida? Well, the cost.
Now, Wilkin, Bad Monkey does seem quite the natural filmmaking candidate for Florida. It's based on the novel by the quintessentially Florida author Carl Hiaasen. It's loaded with all kinds of Florida backdrops and situations and characters. A no-brainer, right? But I guess the sense from your report is that even obvious stories like this would still have trouble getting filmed here in Florida. And you mentioned there that magic word, cost. What are the big obstacles for film and TV producers today in Florida, Wilkin?
Yeah, Tim. Money, 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 right?
Yeah.
I want to preface by saying there are still small and large production companies and crew members who are working and employing people and doing an excellent job in South Florida. I want to preface by saying that.
Sure.
But the global Hollywood business model is based around tax breaks and other financial incentives, like cash rebates, for example. And your typical film goer is not going to think about that when they're in the movie theaters, right?
Right, because let's remind people what's involved in the cost of a movie. And, you know, just you know, the catering, the hotel rooms, the transportation. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's epic, right?
Oh, absolutely. And Florida, at least at the state level, has done away with one of the very things that attracts entertainment production companies to the state. I know Florida's beautiful, but it needs incentives. And so despite the hard workers here, we still have a lot of business and talent going to nearby states like Georgia, for better financial benefits and opportunities.
Now, this wasn't always the case, obviously. I mentioned Moonlight earlier, a huge Made in Florida cinema success. But even further back in the 1990s, box office smashes like Apollo 13 were being filmed here. Not so long ago, Florida ranked number 3 behind California, New York as a film production site. What was Florida doing right back in those days?
Yeah, I would consider that the honeymoon phase for Florida at that time.
Right.
It was actually ranked 3rd in the country in production revenues, which I didn't know at the time prior to doing this report. But things obviously quickly changed. I spoke with Sandy Leiterman. She's the film commissioner for Broward County and president of Film Florida, which is a nonprofit membership organization for the entertainment production company across the state. And so she told me between 2005 and 2009, the state saw positive returns after investing as much as $25 million per year on tax rebates. Mm-hmm. And then eventually the Florida's legislature approved a budget of nearly $300 million in film incentives and tax credits between 2010 and 2016. But Tim, it was first come, first served program, and the earliest applicant typically received the incentives, leaving little or nothing for the later years. If you recall the film like Magic Mike and Dolphin Tale, right? TV series like Ballers and Bloodlines, they all benefited from that.
Uh-huh.
That incentive money dried up earlier than expected. Good for the film industry, not good for the state.
And so a lot of state officials just concluded that Florida wasn't seeing the return on the investment anymore that they were hoping for?
Yeah, they were right. By 2014, the money dried up. 2 years later, Florida lawmakers ended the film incentive program after a state report concluded that the program had yielded minimum returns on each dollar invested, generating 43 cents for every dollar the program spent. And so conservative legislators and groups advocated against the program, saying it didn't give taxpayers a bang for their buck. But Tim, there's always complexity when it comes to this.
Sure.
Leiterman said the state ironically lost hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue from films and TV that were not shot in the state during that time. And
right.
So the full economic impact of the film industry is hard to quantify. Like you said earlier, you know, she estimates that the absence of a statewide film incentive program has cost the state over $2
billion. $2 billion, right. That was a figure that really stood out to me in your report. Yeah.
Yeah. Hundreds of thousands of dollars in indirect spend, like you mentioned earlier, just retails, hotel nights,
sure,
and other services.
So what is happening now, Wilkin, to revive interest in Florida as a film and TV production location, and who's leading the revival in terms of local film commissions and groups like that? What sort of new incentives are being developed for filmmakers here now?
Yeah, the nonprofit organization I mentioned earlier, Film Florida, is partnering with film commissioners, and they are actually cooking up a campaign to better market the state, which is what a state film office would have done. And so at the same time, individual counties are offering tiered incentive programs for film, TV, and commercials. Production companies have to essentially meet various qualifications for these particular programs.
Right.
And Miami-Dade County, which is where you're at right now, in May, actually announced that they were offering a tiered incentive program for film up to $50 million over the next 5 years through a cash rebate of up to 20%. Fort Lauderdale has had an active program. Productions have to spend a minimum of $400,000 in Broward County to receive a 15% rebate. And it's no different than the state of Georgia. Like I mentioned earlier, lawmakers there in the state of Georgia offer 20% in state income tax credits as long as a production company spends a minimum of $500,000 in the state. So it's basically incentivizing production companies to not only shoot in their county, in their state, but to also hire local and stay in the county much longer so that the county benefits from the money that is being spent there.
Well, on the line right now, we have Nerissa from Fort Lauderdale, who makes the good point that this is important because she's seeing a lot more film students budding in Florida. Hi, Nerissa. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup.
Thanks for having me on. How are you?
Great. So what are you seeing?
So as an educator, I was able to grow a film program at a high school 10 times in a matter of 3 years.
Which high school was that?
And That was at South Broward High School.
Uh-huh.
And doing film and media studies. And the kids are seeing the potential for careers in media and interactive gaming. And they see that the commercials and music videos are being filmed here, but they are not understanding that there's support here, that there's other people here. So I really hope that we can keep in mind that we don't want these wonderful and talented kids to leave.
Right. No, that's a great point, Narissa. Thanks for pointing out that we do have this new generation of filmmakers, you know, coming of age in Florida that will need this kind of help. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Wilkin Brutus about efforts to bring movie making back to Florida. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Wilkin, for example, why did the producers of the Apple TV Plus production of Bad Monkey that starts streaming this month decide Florida was a good place for them to shoot, not just story-wise, but business-wise?
You know, to echo that caller, Florida is still a very attractive place. People still want to shoot here. You know, I spoke to Bill Lawrence, you know, the producer of Bad Monkey, and he said, quite frankly, it was about the authenticity of the scene. He said Apple TV Plus would have shot elsewhere if it weren't for the plea to shoot in Florida by Bill and Carl, you know, specifically capturing what makes Florida such a captivating place, the beaches, communities, the culture, the history. And he said he believes more Hollywood production companies would shoot here if the money was right. And now, so that was his reasoning.
Besides Bad Monkey, what are some other examples of films or shows being shot here or that are being planned for shooting here that give film boosters hope that Florida filmmaking is rebounding?
Yeah, I think, you know, I received data that showed Bad Boys 4, Ride or Die, you know, the action comedy starring Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. That production company spent $4 million as part of its shoot in Fort Lauderdale. It didn't take advantage of the Fort Lauderdale production incentive program because they didn't meet the requirement to shoot much longer within the county, but it is indicative of Hollywood production companies still wanting to shoot in Florida. And so experts have told me that because it's still a hot spot, not only for its scene, but for its culture and its positive business environment, once you do find a crew members who are willing to work, you do find more crew members who are willing to stay.
Right.
And so that talent remains here and it circulates here versus leaving. So,
and finally, we just in the last 30 seconds we've got here, Wilkin, Palm Beach County, where you're speaking to us from now, seems to be showing particularly big energy for putting Florida back on the movie making radar screen. What's going on there that impresses you?
Very interesting. While tourism is often touted as an economic byproduct of local shoots, Palm Beach County has turned inwards, Tim. They place more emphasis on their 160 local production companies and specific content that centers in the happenings of Palm Beach County. So, for example, the county commissioner, Michelle Hillary, told me in 2023, the county saw unscripted film and TV generate a record $247 million.
That is impressive, but we're going to have to leave it there, unfortunately.
Yep,
Wilkin.
No,
Wilkin Brutus is WLRN's Palm Beach County reporter. Thanks as always, Wilkin.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Finally on the Roundup, last week on the Florida Roundup, South Florida Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz weighed in on Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's visit to the U.S. and what he needs to do to bring about a ceasefire and the release of Israeli hostages in the bloody 10-month-old Gaza war with the Palestinian militant group Hamas. Wasserman Schultz is Jewish and strongly pro-Israel, so we wanted to include a voice from our local Palestinian community, especially after this week's assassination of Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh in Iran, presumably by Israel. I spoke with Mohammed Gumrawi, who is the assistant director at Florida International University's Jaffer Center for Muslim World Studies and a director of the Jerusalem Peace Institute.
I do think there is absolutely going to be an impact on these ceasefire negotiations. Haniyeh was the one that was really leading the talks, at least politically, through mediators Egypt and Qatar on the Hamas side. And so with his killing, I think it's really going to create a lot of difficulties with trying to reach a ceasefire, especially in terms of Israel having a genuine partner, and even Israel itself serving as a genuine partner. You know, it's really difficult to say you are trying to reach a ceasefire, an end of this conflict, a release of the hostages, while simultaneously assassinating leaders of the groups that you are trying to negotiate with.
Grimawi, though, told me he does see one bit of hope in this week's events.
President Biden really needs to look at this and continue to exert pressure on Israel and the Netanyahu government by saying, okay, listen, you've had, you know, some of these recent so-called wins from the Israeli perspective. You've managed to kill Ismail Haniyeh and the Hezbollah commander in Beirut. It's time to now wind down this conflict, because really this is not only putting the ceasefire negotiations at risk, it's also putting the entire region at risk for really an escalation in the conflict.
That was FIU's Mohammed Gumrawi. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives engineered the program. Julia Cooper answered the phones today. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.